This is the story of how small actions can change history. The story of how an iconic plane was designed and built against all the odds by men and women facing the threat of enemy invasion. It's also the story of where it was built. In the most unlikely of places and by the most remarkable of people. I'm Tuppence Middleton. And this is Spitfire, the People's Plane. The factories making the planes had been bombed. September 1940 had seen three devastating raids on the coastal city of Southampton by the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe. That had led to the hatching of an extraordinary plan by the British government. A plan that would take Spitfire production far away from the factory floor, away from the smouldering remains of the bombed-out buildings, to anywhere and everywhere that could take them. Workshops, garages, shops, even a laundry, all across the bomb-weary city. But the first inklings of this plan emerged before the first bombs fell. In the weeks before the devastating bombs, while the factory workers were facing more and more air raids, the groundwork was being laid for the big move.
After a search, it was decided that Hendy's garage in Pound Street Lane and Seward's garage in Winchester Road would be ideal. Both had an upper and lower floor, and in both cases, the upper floor was reached by a ramp, by means of which lorries could deliver and collect fuselages or parts with ease.
This is an account by Dennis Webb, just 33 years old, with one of the most important jobs in the world at that moment, although it might not sound like it. He is the manager of the spare parts department at Supermarine, the company that designed and built the Spitfire.
Elliot asked me to get all the windows blacked out and some spare fuselage jigs dumped over there in case they were needed.
He was a very versatile engineer, very quick to turn his hand to all sorts of jobs within the company.
Local historian Alan Matlock has made it his business to know more about people like Dennis Webb.
He joined in the late 20s and was working for them still in the 60s, so he was Supermarine through and through.
Dennis Webb is relentlessly cheerful, occasionally brusque, and didn't suffer fools gladly.
He is very straight and very fair. He wanted to see the best job that could be done in every way.
We did a similar job at Seward's garage in Winchester Road and earmarked Lowther's garage in Shirley for a tool room.
These businesses were all to the north of the city, close enough to be accessible, far enough away to be out of the action.
There was no difficulty in obtaining the use of these garages, as private motoring had virtually ceased and there were no new cars to be displayed in the showrooms. And so most garages were only too glad to turn their showrooms into workshops to pay their way.
They didn't start their preparations a moment too soon.
On Sunday evening, 15th of September, I just got home from the works. When the air raid warning was sounded and we heard explosions in the general direction of Woolston and soon saw clouds of smoke rising. And I guessed that the Jerrys were having a crack at the works.
Dennis Webb sees the first of the three bombing raids from his home in Nerling, around a mile from the centre of town, where he lives with his wife Mary and baby daughter Anne.
When I got back to the works, there was no sign of serious damage, although a host of windows had been broken, and the works fire brigade were busy clearing up the remains of broken glass.
These first bombs didn't do much damage, but it sent a shockwave right back to the heart of government, and to the Ministry of Aircraft Production, led by Lord Beaverbrook.
I think it was the next morning that two of Beaverbrook's boys arrived, apparently without any credentials or authorisation, to announce to Pratt, the works manager, that they were here to disperse the factory.
This is the task that Dennis and others were suddenly faced with. To take to the streets and deliver the message to business owners and landlords across the city that their buildings, their businesses, their livelihoods and sometimes their homes were needed for the war effort and they were to clear out.
It was a disaster overcome by improvisation and guts. They just had to get production moving again, taking on places that had never thought of being aircraft factories all over the city.
Our guide to these places, hidden away in the streets of Southampton, is Alan. He knows more than most about this aspect of his city's history.
I've been living in Shirley, Southampton, for about 40 years.
Alan is a retired English teacher and a Spitfire dispersal site super sleuth.
A couple of years ago, I looked into the stories behind all these places around the city that had been used after the bombing.
Exactly where these businesses were has until now always been something of a mystery. Notes were scarce and maps non-existent for fear they might fall into the wrong hands. Place names change, roads get rerouted, old buildings knocked down or replaced. Memories fade.
Initially, during the wartime, people didn't talk about what they were doing. They kept it quiet. There were no addresses. Finding out exactly where they were wasn't always straightforward.
As Dennis Webb bustles around Southampton, barking orders and making arrangements in his usual style, we'll retrace his steps and find out a bit more about the places and the people that became such an important part of the Spitfire story. While others were still recovering from the shock of the air raids, Dennis was ready to go to work. First on his list was a laundry. A huge building full of drums, dryers, presses, racks, rollers and irons.
I was sent to see the manager of the Sunlight Laundry in Winchester Road, which was on the outskirts of Southampton, and to tell him we were about to requisition his works and ask him to move out as quickly as possible. I don't remember any great opposition, although rather naturally the idea wasn't popular. But they soon began to move all their machinery out.
The Sunlight Laundry was owned by a guy called George Goldsmith. And George, when asked to vacate his premises, did so with very little resistance.
All the laundry machines were moved out and the machine tools for making Spitfires were moved in. They were making parts of the wings and sections of fuselage.
Sunlight Laundry had got all their stuff out by the weekend, but we found that the roof trusses were absolutely deep in cotton lint, which was festooned everywhere, giving me the answer as to why nothing lasted long when sent to a laundry. It took us all quite a while to get it all cleared off.
In the same street, just next door in fact, there was the Hanson Dorset bus garage. It had one thing that many of the other locations didn't: a high ceiling. High enough to house a bus, and high enough for the enormous frames or jigs used to construct the Spitfire's distinctive leaf-shaped wings. Only problem was, someone had got there first.
My next task was to go and see the deputy town clerk, whose name was Bernard Fishwick, and ask him to shift all the trailer pumps of the fire brigade out of the Hanson Dorset bus garage.
Trailer pumps were small fire engines that could be towed behind any vehicle, and they had the whole of the bus depot filled with these and surrounded by sandbags.
Fishwick refused to clear them out, on the basis that the fire brigade trailer pumps were of more importance to the town than bloody Spitfires. My argument that bloody Spitfires in adequate numbers could make trailer pumps unnecessary was not accepted, and so I said that the matter would have to be referred to Beaverbrook and Company, who would undoubtedly enforce their removal.
That's Max Beaverbrook, the charismatic, bullish newspaper magnate, politician and newly appointed head of the Ministry for Aircraft Production.
If they needed it, they could get backup from Lord Beaverbrook, whose bully boys would come down from London and use their emergency powers to enforce this, and the local police would come along to make sure that it did happen.
The deputy town clerk had removed his trailer pumps by the weekend, if I remember correctly, but all the sandbags were still there, and we were trying to find out from him where we could dump them, it being anatomically impossible to put it where we would have liked.
Time was passing. More space was needed, wherever it was. Dennis Webb's next steps took him to the back of a cemetery, an unlikely place for a Spitfire factory, you may think.
Someone told me that there were a row of empty huts behind Hollybrook Cemetery which might be useful for a finished parts store headquarters, and I had a look at them and agreed.
This row of huts became known as Hollybrook Stores. There was only one problem. The huts were separate. To get from one to the other, you'd have to go outside, letting light flood out into the dark of the blacked-out city, and that would be dangerous. In typical style, Dennis wastes no time in coming up with a solution.
I went to a local builder's in Winchester Road and got him to build a brick passageway to link up all the huts at Hollybrook Stores. While in the builder's office drawing up plans, a woman clerk started to complain that with Supermarine in Winchester Road, they would get bombed now. I said, well, Woolston had most of it up to now, and surely in wartime we should share and share alike.
As Webb left the office, he made some rude words about this lady, who turned out to be the builder's wife.
Dennis Webb was back in the old Woolston Works having lunch. This was on Tuesday, September the 24th, the day of the second bombing raid on the factory.
I could see the full tragedy. The bombs had missed the target, the works, as usual, and instead had landed on some of the shelters, which in one case had turned into a heap of soil and sand, with arms and legs sticking out. Rescuers were already frantically digging in the hopes that some people might get out alive.
Let's leave the waterfront for a second and the still smoking factories and travel north, across the city, to Seward's garage, one of the places Dennis Webb had been so busy preparing. On the roof is a boy called Ray Penny, an apprentice at Supermarine, who that very morning had been working on Spitfires at Woolston. He's 14 years old.
They could look across the city and actually see the second of the bombing raids back on the banks of the river. His name was Ray Penny, and he was an apprentice who'd been sent from Woolston to get things started at Seward's garage. And when the siren went, instead of taking cover, they went up on the roof because clearly their area was not going to be bombed. And they could see across the city the smoke and the fire coming from the original factory.
From Seward's garage, Ray stood and watched the second of the three bombing raids strike his workplace. His friends and colleagues were there, but he was here, on the roof, watching and surviving.
He lost friends of his. The youngest was 14 years old, who died at the Woolston Works. So someone he would have known on the same scheme as him.
It was a perfect demonstration of the urgency of their work, to move production as quickly as possible out and away from the factory.
For many of them, the fear factor was balanced out by the excitement of it. Workers, both young and old, were incredibly resilient. Maybe it was the wartime spirit, maybe it was the camaraderie of being in a team and working together and not letting the others down. But the day after the bombing, almost everyone reported for work.
For whatever reason, the order to disperse was given, and with it, the requisitioning authority to take over whatever buildings were considered suitable. The action that followed, by day and night, was little short of miraculous.
One of those reporting for work was Cyril Russell, the 19-year-old apprentice we met earlier in the series. Having survived the bombing raids that ended the life of his friend, Peggy Moon, still, he saw no reason not to show up.
I went back into the works to collect my tools and saw for myself that men were busily uprooting the vital jigs whilst the almost undamaged machine shop was actually working under a missing roof. On the following Monday, I was informed by the Labour Exchange to report to Hendy's garage just off Southampton High Street. And upon arrival, there were fuselage jigs that had been uprooted from Woolston and reset in what had been, on the previous Thursday, one of Southampton's largest garage and car showrooms. So in 5 days after what had looked like a disaster, I was back building Spitfire fuselages, and I was by no means the only one, or this the only working unit.
Cyril Russell was to be moved many times over the coming months, but first, There was the business of salvaging what remained from the factory.
I was busy trying to get people and things sorted out along Winchester Road on the 26th of September when the Germans came over again to put the finishing touches to their Tuesday's work. One could hear the pounding going on quite clearly, and I was thankful that we had got some men and material out in the interval, although the bulk was still to be shifted.
This time, finally, the damage was terminal.
We had been moving the stores from Itchen to Hollybrook with a certain degree of method, but after this further narrow squeak I decided to take rather drastic steps and told the storeman to get everything out and onto the lorry and take it to Hollybrook. Tip it out onto the floor of one of the empty buildings, while we moved the bins and got everything back to normal. The Thursday raid really put paid to any idea of using the Woolston or Itchen works again. This, then, was the end of the Supermarine works at Woolston, but we had done our jobs of producing every possible Spitfire. It was rather a sad business collecting all the stuff out of my old office after all these years spent there. But on the other hand, I felt an enormous sense of relief that the long-expected chop had come, and I had survived, although sadly so many others had not. It was completely irrational, but a curious smell and aura hung around the places, a sort of witch's brew made up of violence, fear, and death. We were at last free to get the hell out of it. In the process of doing just that, we became less polite about everything. And those bloody sandbags in the Hants and Dorset bus garage were bulldozed up into a stream of commandeered lorries and dumped into the tramway's depot at Portswood. After Woolston, Hollybrook Stores and Winchester Road felt 1,000 miles from the war.
This is the point that the dispersal really begins to pick up speed and fans out to villages and towns far beyond the city, taking the risk of German raids with them. Next time on Spitfire, the People's Plane, it's a race against time. A race to get planes built, assembled, and delivered. All while the German Air Force builds in strength.